ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly digest of arts and culture news from across the globe. I'm Sky Kirkham. After a period of major acquisitions across the gaming industry, Microsoft have switched to layoffs and cancellations, even as profits seemingly remain high. After a fourth round of layoffs hit the company, what does it mean for the industry at large? And is this another example of a streaming service causing problems for artists? And Creative Australia have announced the latest round of projects that will be supported by the Creative Future Fund, 20 large-scale projects spread across the country with an emphasis on ambition. We'll dive into that news later in the show. But first, the headlines with Hilary Harper. Hilary, welcome. UNESCO has added Marajuga to the World Heritage List.
Yes, Arts in 30 reported in May on concerns that the rock art in Marajuga, which dates back 50,000 years, might be experiencing ongoing damage because of the industrial pollution around the site. The traditional custodians have been trying to have the site recognised for decades, but advisers to the UNESCO committee had recommended postponing the recognition until the industry presence in the site was reduced. After a campaign in Paris by the traditional owners, the committee has agreed to add Marajuga to the World Heritage List, but an amendment to the listing softened the language regarding the prevention of further industrial development on the site. Now, Federal Environment Minister Murray Watt has said on RN Breakfast that the new World Heritage status will not affect the federal government's decision on the extension of Woodside's gas project.
Elsewhere, two fictional bands are dominating the music charts.
Yeah, Huntrix and Sarja Boys, the two bands at the centre of the new Netflix film K-pop Demon Hunters, are proving a hit worldwide with six tracks in the ARIA Top 20 in Australia and even more in America's Billboard charts and Spotify's Top 50. So the bands may be fictional, but the artists behind them aren't. In an extremely K-pop backstory, EJ, who is the Huntrix lead vocalist and co-writer of many of the movie songs, switched to songwriting and producing after being judged too old at her debut. These are definitely her biggest hits to date, and the album itself is number three on the Billboard charts, just behind Lorde's latest, and it's the first movie soundtrack to hit the top 10 since Wicked.
And well-deserved, too. These songs don't just stand up within the movie, I think they stand up as genuine pop songs, so it's quite an impressive achievement from the writers there. Worth a listen if you haven't checked it out yet. Hilary, what else is making the news?
Quite a bit, Sky. The Chinese artist Gao Zhen, who lives in the United States but was detained last year when visiting family in China, has pled not guilty to a charge of defaming Mao Zedong and engaged one of China's most eminent lawyers to defend him. The art in question, satirical works depicting Mao, is more than 15 years old, and the law he's alleged to have broken was passed in 2021.
Interesting timing.
Yeah, indeed. Back home, opposition arts spokesman Julian Lisa has demanded an independent inquiry into Creative Australia, citing reporting by The Australian into the peer review process, which showed that people who'd received funding were also, in separate rounds, used to judge applications. The Federal Art Minister, Tony Burke, has dismissed the call, saying that the process is the same process of peer review used by the previous government. If Mr. Lisa has found a way to conduct peer review without involving peers, he should explain this. In Europe again, the Centre Pompidou Metz in France is facing criticism from artists after choosing to cancel a survey of Caribbean and Guyanese art. The show, titled Van Levee, was due to open in October, but the gallery's director has said that a difficult budgetary context is forcing us to reorganise the exhibitions and events initially planned in our programme in a drastic manner. The newspaper Le Monde published an open letter signed by artists that back the show's curator and said, "We also share her ambition and offer her our unwavering support." A few people to bid farewell to, Sky, as well. Mark Snow, a composer with more than 250 television and film credits, has died at the age of 78. Snow recorded his first album in 1968 with the group New York Rock and Roll Ensemble, but it was the theme to the TV show The X-Files that is likely to be seen as his crowning achievement, an instantly recognisable tune that feels like a symbol of the 1990s. I can hear it going through my head right now. And Rebecca Del Rio, who performed Llorando, the haunting a cappella Spanish version of Roy Orbison's Crying in the David Lynch film Mulholland Drive, has died at the age of 57. Del Rio's musical career was mixed with a car accident and label sale blocking her first two albums, but her collaborations with Lynch, she also appeared on Twin Peaks, The Return, showed the amazing potential of her voice. So, vale, Rebecca Del Rio.
Llorando. Llorando no es fácil de entender que al verte otra vez yo esté llorando.
Vale, indeed, a stunning voice. Hilary Harper there. Hilary, thank you. The voice of Radio National, Monday through Wednesdays, making a special guest appearance on the show.
Pleasure, Skye.
You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. Microsoft has laid off more than 9,000 employees, with hundreds of those coming from the Xbox or Microsoft Gaming division. For a while there, the company was in a period of serious acquisition. It felt like Microsoft was buying up every game studio that wasn't nailed down, and even some that were. But over the last few years, they've been making headlines for cancelling projects and shuttering the studios they've acquired. This recent round of layoffs is the fourth to hit the gaming division over the last 2 years, with 1,900 jobs cut in January 2024 and a further 650 jobs gone in the gaming division in September. So what does this mean for the future of the industry and for gamers? Jodie McGregor is a games journalist and the weekend editor of PC Gamer. Jodie, welcome.
Hi, Skye.
So why has Microsoft spent so much money over the last few years acquiring all of these studios, leading up to the point we're at now?
Well, like a lot of video game publishers, Microsoft and its Xbox gaming division saw a huge boom during the pandemic. A lot of people were spending all of their time at home. They didn't have a lot of stuff to do. The video game industry is one of the few industries that really saw an upturn in profits during the course of the pandemic. And I think a little optimistically, a lot of them assumed that that sort of rise would continue. And what we've actually seen is a post-pandemic drop-off with the cost of living crisis and just the fact that people actually do quite like going outside and seeing their friends in person. And so from sort of 2022 onwards, there has been a downturn in the video game industry, and suddenly all of those acquisitions, all of those new projects that were greenlit are a little bit unfeasible. With Microsoft especially, their investment in AI, I think they've said $80 billion they're investing in AI over the course of the next year. And that's where they want to be spending their money. So even though Microsoft is doing quite well for itself overall, that does mean they have to lay off a bunch of people to, I think the head of Xbox Gaming called it increasing their agility.
Right.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it is a natural contraction in the industry, you would say?
I think so. It seems in retrospect like a very obvious thing. Mm-hmm. But I guess if you were there at the peak of everyone playing Animal Crossing and everyone playing Among Us and online gaming especially having such a huge boom because it was a great way to keep in touch with your friends when you were locked down. You know, the idea that we would all keep playing those games, that we would all still be hooked on Animal Crossing now, I guess it made sense to them at the time.
I've seen reports of AAA games, the sort of big, top-of-the-line, big-budget games, costing hundreds of millions of dollars to develop now. They have full casts of actors, writers, producers, animators, as well as all of the developers. Is that sustainable in the situation where we find ourselves now? I mean, the two games you just cited, Animal Crossing and Among Us, those are small, like, micro-budget compared to the big games.
Yeah, big-budget gaming has become bigger and bigger budget. It's not just the increased cost of like the increased fidelity, the expectation of graphical realism, but also the scale of those games. People want games to keep them engaged for longer, open world games that take up more of their time. And yet people are very resistant to paying more for those games. So there's sort of a hard ceiling on how much people will pay for a big budget video game. And yet they cost more and more to make every year. Mm. So it's probably not sustainable.
Yeah, I certainly know when they cross the $100 threshold, that's where my brain starts struggling with the idea of paying that much.
Yeah, exactly. That is like a hard limit. And you see that in the US as well, where when a game crosses like the $80 line, people just decide it's not really worth it.
I think a relevant part of this conversation when it comes to Microsoft and Xbox is Game Pass, which is a platform that they've set up in the last few years. Can you just give a bit of background as to what that is for anyone who hasn't encountered it yet?
Yeah, Game Pass is Xbox's attempt at creating the Netflix for video games, which is something that has been tried by a lot of companies, Google with Stadia. And Game Pass is one of the more popular ways of doing it. You pay a monthly subscription and you get access to a rotating library of games, just like Netflix, which you can play on your Xbox. You can play them on your PC if you've got Game Pass for PC. And as well as being sort of an archival library of games, a lot of new release games come out day one on Game Pass, which is like, it's great value. And I have a lot of friends who play Game Pass exclusively now, but it's not great for all of the people spending, as you said, millions of dollars developing video games. And then obviously that bites into your sales if on day one it's on Game Pass.
Is it fair to compare to something like Spotify, where the convenience of having that is great for consumers? It's cheap, it's an easy way to access a range of things. But for the artists who are creating it, the financial stability, it's hard to look at that and understand where the profit could possibly come from for creators.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure it works out very well for smaller creators who get paid by Microsoft to put their mid-sized games onto Game Pass. But the high-end games, the big budget ones, the ones that are trying to sell for $100 or more, someone getting that for their $30 Game Pass freebie, obviously that's got to bite into their profits.
Mm. Rafael Colantonio, the president of Wolfeye Studios, has said that, quote, Game Pass is an unsustainable model that has been increasingly damaging the industry for a decade. I don't think Game Pass can exist with other models. They'll either kill everyone else or give up. And it's quite strong words from a head of a development studio. What are your thoughts on that perspective? Is it as dire as the picture he's painting?
I think in the long term, it could be. There's definitely a sense that video games, as I said, they want to increase their prices, and yet at the same time, people are able to get them cheaper and cheaper, not just with Game Pass, but with also the rise of like free-to-play games and subscription models kind of dying off in favor of people getting a game for free and then paying for extras with microtransactions. And those two things combined really are sort of eroding the idea of there being value in just buying a video game for a flat amount of money.
Mm. Sony have also been laying off staff in recent times. Nintendo seem to be taking a different approach. They're saying that they're going to aim for games with a smaller scope and quicker development cycles, but not lay off staff. Is that just a difference in corporate culture, or is it a different way of looking at the industry?
I think it's both a cultural and a legal difference. The fact that the majority of the layoffs that we've seen come from inside the US is not a coincidence. The US labor laws for video game developers especially aren't great. Some of them have unionized, but a lot of them haven't, and a lot of them are sort of covered by existing unions in part, like the Communication Workers of America. Video game voice actors are covered by SAG-AFTRA now, and a lot of those have been striking as companies want to replace them with AI. Obviously in Japan, it has much stricter labor laws, and so they can't just lay off a bunch of people whenever they want to be a little more agile.
Mm. Speaking of SAG-AFTRA, the video game actors have recently ended a strike that's lasted almost 11 months over concerns around payments and AI. The new agreement requires companies to obtain the written consent of performers in order to create replicas of their work, and studios will also have to pay performers for the use of those replicas at a rate commensurate to in-person work. Is that a good outcome for the industry at large, for the artists that make up that industry?
I think it was probably the best that could be hoped for. We've seen that some of the people who went on strike, like staff working for NetEase on Genshin Impact, At first, that game, which is a live service game, which is constantly being updated and having new storylines added to it, it just went sort of text only for the characters being portrayed by actors who went on strike, but then did actually start replacing them with non-union actors. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think this is the best outcome they could hope for because, yeah, there isn't as much solidarity as you would hope for.
With the future we're looking at now, with the challenges of Game Pass, is there still scope for ambition for the artistic side? The indie side of gaming seems to be where a lot of the most creative work is being done. Is that still likely to continue with the industry and the state it's in?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, indie game development is never a safe bet. It's always been risky. But at that smaller scale, there is less risk. You are a handful of people probably operating out of a bedroom somewhere. You can afford to have that kind of artistic ambition. And also, there are a substantial number of players who don't demand high levels of graphical fidelity, who are in favor of games having, you know, a more impressionistic art style rather than one that looks in that sort of uncanny valley of realistic people. And those games, I think, still have potential to be the most interesting.
Jody, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Guy.
Jody McGregor is a games journalist and the weekend editor of PC Gamer. And for more on this story, you can check out Download This Show with Ray Johnston on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Arts in 30, your weekly digest of arts and culture news from across the globe. I'm Sky Kirkham. And with $7.8 million spread across 20 projects, the Creative Futures Fund has a goal of supporting ambitious work. The Executive Director of Arts Investment, Alice Nash, calls it an investment in imagination. And the fund has just announced its first round of projects with significant partnerships between publicly funded arts bodies and private investment. The projects for 2025 are everything from a new play by Susie Miller to outdoor events set against the backdrop of the night sky in remote Western Australia. To talk about the philosophy and the practicalities, I'm joined by the Director of Creative Futures Fund, Wendy Martin. Wendy, welcome.
Thank you, Sky.
So, Wendy, what is the purpose of this fund? How is it different to other funding bodies at Creative Australia?
So, the fund was part of the Revive Cultural Policy that the government released in 2023. It was named in the policy as a works of scale fund. And the government wanted to see ambitious new work telling Australian stories being shared with wide audiences in Australia and potentially across the world. Last year, Creative Australia put out a call out through an EOI process, and we received 300 expressions of interest from people with ideas that were intended to meet the aims of the fund.
Projects of scale, ambition, they're exciting words to hear, but I feel like they can be seen as almost a bit of a dirty word in this country. It often feels like everything in the arts has to be made on the smell of an oily rag, or it's perceived as a waste of money. How did this fund make it past those usual concerns, or what does it allow you to do when you bypass those concerns?
Well, I think, Sky, the scale of the available investment is substantial. So there are two streams to the fund, the development stream and the delivery stream. In the development stream, people could put forward a project and request up to $250,000. In the delivery stream, which was for work that had already had an outing that was ready to go through its final stages and be delivered to audiences or to the public, depending what the art form is, people could apply for up to $1.5 million. Interestingly, none of the projects that we have funded have received that level. In fact, the highest single investment is around $880,000. And I think one of the reasons really goes to your point is that artists have not had the opportunity to think in the way that this fund and this level of investment allows. And I think also, you know, coming out of COVID, people, organizations have been struggling to get back on their feet. And this fund really allows for ambition. And so with the second round opening imminently, we will hope to see, I guess, an understanding of what ambition can look like. People have had a year to think about what are the projects that they want to bring to this fund.
So you'd be pushing artists to be more ambitious?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, say, our state theatre companies, our medium-sized performing arts organisations, what is business as usual, which was one of the things we encourage people to think beyond business as usual. So to look at an example that they gave in the Revive document, in the Revive policy, they talked about Tim Winton's Cloud Street, which went from novel to incredible stage play that went across the country and around the world and then became a television miniseries. We haven't seen works of that scale in recent years, in part, I think, because of COVID. And so when you look at projects like you mentioned in your introduction, Susie Miller's Strong is the New Pretty, which looks at the beginning of the AFL Women's League in Australia, that's intended to have a cast of 9 or 10 people. At the moment, a cast of that size just is not possible.
Really? 9 or 10 people would be too large for most Australian theatre?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the time to develop work slowly and carefully with working with a dramaturg, giving weeks and weeks of development, it just doesn't happen. And so in part, I mean, we're now focused on performing arts, but in part, this fund enables that careful work to happen so that works can have an extended life. You know, if a wonderful idea gets to the stage and it's not necessarily as well realised as it might be, it means it's not going to have a future life. And hopefully this level of funding that the Creative Futures Fund enables will allow works to have future lives, to tour the country, to tour the world.
Mm. You mentioned earlier that there'd been more than 300 applications for the first round. We've seen 20 successful this round. Is that a question of these were the only 20 that deserved to be funded, or a limitation of the amount of money available at the moment?
There's an expression that we use at Creative Australia, which is unfunded excellence. And often we see, you know, heartbreakingly, I suppose, that there's just not enough money to fund the incredible projects that people are looking for across all of our programs. The Creative Futures Fund this year, it was new. There is incredible ambitious work in the fund, but I think we're going to get more ambitious work in the next round, as I said earlier, as people have become clear about the idea of what our expectations are and what is possible from this fund.
The fund's also prioritising projects that can leverage other sources of income. What do you see as the role of that mix of income between government funding versus private and philanthropic funding of the arts in Australia? What should ideally be the role of the government?
Well, the government is here to obviously support these ambitious projects. But what we're saying with the Creative Futures Fund is that look at the subject matter you want to explore, and are there cross-sector partners who would be interested in seeing this work come into being? I'll give you an example. There's a project called Hobartica by an organisation based in Hobart called Beaker Street. And Hobartica is looking at stories from Antarctica, and they have built partnerships with the CSIRO and other science-based organisations, and also tourism. And so I think by encouraging partnerships, we're amplifying the storytelling to new parts beyond, to areas beyond the art sector. And we're seeing this a lot within the projects that we are funding. So, for example, a project like coming from Merengong Theatre Company in New South Wales, it's a work, a site-specific work based on Catherine MacKinnon's Miles Franklin Award-nominated novel Storyland. And that work is going to be presented at the foot of the Illawarra Escarpment in Wollongong. And again, Merengong Theatre has built incredible partnerships with the local university, the university in Wollongong, with the local tourism body. And those partners are going to help them amplify their stories to new audiences, but also they recognise the value in the broad storytelling and finding new ways of sharing stories.
Well, I am particularly looking forward to catching Sean Tan's Stories from the City when it makes its way to WA in hopefully the near future. So lots of projects to be excited about coming out of this fund. Wendy, thank you so much for your time.
That's a pleasure, Skye. Thank you.
Wendy Martin is the director of the Creative Futures Fund. You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. I'm Skye Kirkham. And every week, we invite an expert from across the ABC's music networks to showcase one special song just for you, our track of the week. And this week, Ellie Parnell from RN's Music Show joins me. Ellie, welcome. What's our track and why is this the one that we should be putting in our ears?
Thanks, Skye. We've got an artist called Billy Strings, and I was disappointed to find out that that is an alias. His real name is William Apostle, and he is in Australia for the first time this week, so that's why we're going to hear a track from him. What's interesting about Billy Strings is that he's playing these huge venues while he's in Australia, like arenas and massive sort of theatres, and he's a bluegrass musician. So we're talking guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, double bass, no drums, like proper bluegrass music. And it's not since the sort of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack came out 25 years ago that bluegrass has had such a sort of moment. And in the kind of mainstream charts, this guy Billy Strings is just hugely popular and hugely successful. So it's exciting that he's here in Australia at the moment. He's an incredible guitar picker, so we'll hear that on this track. And he's a good singer, he's a great songwriter. He's in his early 30s, he grew up in Michigan but has sort of made his way to Nashville as lots of musicians do. And I think he does a beautiful job of kind of honouring the tradition. And with genres like bluegrass, there is a lot of tradition, you know, that must be honoured. But he also brings in his kind of modern influences. He's a big fan of psychedelic rock. He likes metal. A lot of his fans are deadheads and fishheads. So that's people that like the Grateful Dead or the band Fish, you know, people who are happy to see a band jam for 10, 15, 20 minutes at a time, like on stage. So yeah, he's just got this broad appeal. The kids love him. He's big online, you know, old folkies love him, country music.
What is it that's let him cut through? Because there's a lot of great bluegrass out there. Not many of them, as you say, are playing stadiums. What's let Billy Strings cut through?
It's interesting. I think it's the combo of his just incredible guitar work. He's very, very good, very talented, and also a great songwriter. So a lot of the songs on his albums, he does play some traditional, some standard sort of bluegrass, but it's mostly original, and he's just a brilliant songwriter. And he's got a great voice. He sounds decades older than he actually is. He's only sort of early 30s. So it's just talent. I think he's pretty down to earth. In COVID, he was really starting to pick up his popularity in COVID, and then, you know, no gigs were happening. So he did drive-through concerts. So people in the States would pull up in their cars, roll down the windows, or, you know, tune into the radio dial, and he would play these shows to fans. So he just kept that momentum going, which was great for him because, you know, in COVID, a lot of artists lost momentum. So yeah, just a sort of bunch of things. So it's great that he's come out to Australia and yeah, these massive shows, and people will be surprised. They might not have heard of him, and, you know, selling out arenas, crazy.
Well, for anyone in a car right now, roll down the windows, get ready to imagine yourself at a drive-through concert. Ellie, can you announce our track of the week, please?
So this is called Gone a Long Time, and it's from his album from last year, Highway Prayers.
South to Georgia for two shows in a row. Didn't get much sleep last night the way these drivers roll. Heaven seems so far away, I believe my weary soul will be gone a long time. Saw an awful sight. Well, he took off my overcoat and she turned out the light, and I'll be gone for a long time. Well, a jaybird sees a little worm dancing on the ground. There ain't no hiding place, no matter where you found. I just came from Traverse City, now I'm with the Coochie bound, and I'll be gone a long time. Jesus took the water and turned it in wine. Take them pretty girls and try to make them mine. And I tell them not to worry, that I'll see them down the line, and I'll be gone a long time. Boys, you just don't understand. I'll pick this old guitar until my fingers turn to sand, and I'll be gone a long time. I'll be gone a long time.
That was Gone a Long Time by Billy Strings, the track chosen by our music correspondent Ellie Parnell. And that's all the time we have for today. Arts in 30 is produced by me, Sky Kirkham. C. Benedict is our executive producer. Ross Richardson, our sound engineer. And if you're enjoying the show, let a friend know or leave us a review if you're listening on a third-party platform. It's an important way to help spread the word. I'm Sky Kirkham, and I'll catch you next time here on Arts in 30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.